We are talking today with Karin Bauer. Karin Bauer is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of German Studies at McGill University. Her research is in the areas of cultural and literary theories, the Frankfurt School, gender studies, Nietzsche, minority literature, and contemporary German literature and thought. Her interest focuses in particular on questions of radical aesthetics, i.e. the aesthetics of radicalism, and on narrative strategies of dissent. She is the author of Adorno's Nietzschean Narratives, Critiques of Ideology, Readings of Wagner, and she is here to talk about her new book, Everybody Talks About the Weather, We Don't, The Texts of Ulrich Meinhof. Karin, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here in Seattle first morning in a week when the sun came out.
Very good. So start out, if you would, and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book on her?
I have to backtrack here. Originally, I sought to do a project on the afterlife of Ulrike Meinhof. What interested me as a literary scholar and was that at this point in time, suddenly we have a resurgent of interest in all things radical. You have, of course, Che Guevara t-shirts, you have sort of Ulrike Meinhof, her face popped up in a lot of artworks, in a lot of novels, and also her group, the Red Army faction. So suddenly the Red Army faction seemed to be a little revival in interest, and there's in Germany at least, there's just every week a new book comes out. Many ex-members of the group are writing their memoirs, then there's little scandals in the press about this and that. And so it seems like, although the group was really active only into the 90s, that now historians are talking about the press and so on. So I looked at this. There was an exhibit in Berlin in 2004, and about the Red Army faction. There is novels published. So I looked at these works and I wanted to sort of make sense of why this is happening. And doing so in a North American context, I began to realize there are no texts out there to relate this to. So people don't know who is Ulrike Meinhof. So why would they be interested in her afterlife? Why would anybody be interested in the representations of Ulrike Meinhof, or why we still talk about her if nobody knows who she actually was? So then I looked and I thought there's none of her texts are available, and that's why I came to this project. I thought this was sort of the basis for a continued engagement with that. And I mean, there are still the open questions. So why this resurgent in interest today about the group? And I have some tentative answers for that as well. But this is how I came to it, and I wanted to make these texts available, and contacted the publisher in Germany, and the publisher contacted Ulrike Meinhof's daughters, and eventually we came to an agreement, and that we could translate the columns, and so that's how the book came about.
So when you were growing up, did you read any of her writings? Were you impacted by any of her work?
Yeah. Everybody read Ulrike Meinhof. She published her columns were published in the magazine Konkret, and the title of that magazine refers to, it had a subtitle for a magazine for culture and politics, and it was really the voice of the left, and it was tremendously successful. It was a magazine, one of that was one of its kind, and it still exists today in a very different form, but it's still there. At the height of its circulation, it had about 250,000 copies circulated. That was in 68-69, and at that point was also the point when Ulrike Meinhof stopped writing for the magazine. It has an interesting history. So the Concrete magazine came out of a student paper that was founded by Klaus Rainer Röhl, who eventually married Ulrike Meinhof. And they built up this magazine in the 50s, and they were really sort of the 60s, and they were really the voice to try to bring Germany away from an engagement in nuclear weapons toward a more liberal society. Germany after the war was a tremendously conservative society. It had a conservative government. It engaged, of course, with the Western powers. It chose not to stay neutral. It chose to build up an army again. And all of this was controversial. And so Concrete was really the voice of the left and of the liberals to sort of engage and build up what was then called a counterpublic, to try to go against mainstream and inform the public about other perspectives in the cold, during the years of the Cold War. And so the GDR, the East German government, liked the idea of supporting some of the leftist causes in the West, because they had intersecting interests. So for a number of years, this magazine was actually subsidized by the communist government of East Germany, and until 1964. And then in 1964, things didn't work out too well. The magazine became too cheeky for the East Germans. The East Germans were pretty dogmatic about what they wanted to see. So eventually there was this split. The magazine basically went under, and all the employees were dismissed, until then Röhl decided he was going to try it on his own. And he did. He put some naked women on the cover. That worked and increased the sales. The magazine visually became very different, and it became also not just a magazine for politics and culture, but also a magazine, sort of a lifestyle magazine. It was the first German magazine to talk openly, to write about the pill and what free sex and so everything, all drugs, everything that was talked about openly in the United States, suddenly appeared on the German agenda.
So how did Ulrike Meinhof end up writing at Concrete?
Basically, Concrete recruited her because she was at the time active in the anti-nuclear movement at the University of Münster, and she was an attractive young woman. There weren't at the time very many women out in the forefront, and so the group around Concrete went to recruit her because they thought she was an effective voice. She was at the time, I'll talk a bit about her background. So Ulrike Meinhof was born in 1934. So she is one of the children that grew up during the war, during National Socialism in Germany. She experienced it as a child, and of course that generation is not responsible for anything that happened during that time. Nevertheless, grew up when coming of age in the 50s, feeling guilty about being German, and feeling the responsibility of growing up and seeing the crimes of National Socialism, having to live with that legacy. So, and Ulrike Meinhof grew up in a Protestant household. Her father died very young. Her mother died when she was 14, what became later on a very prominent Christian activist, Protestant activist, Renate Riemek, she was one of the first female professors in Germany, took her in and raised her until Ulrike Meinhof left to go to university. And so, well, she was described by fellow students, Ulrike Meinhof was described by fellow students as a Protestant flute playing girl, because she was rather naive. She prayed before she ate her meals, and she was an outspoken pacifist at the time. So as she became more involved with certain causes, with the Easter March movement, she had many, many connections to the Protestant church, and she always nurtured them till even during the time when she was a terrorist, she was still connected to that. So this is how she came then to write for Concrete, and she was much more than the group that she encountered when she moved to Hamburg to take part of and write for Concrete. She became the editor-in-chief, and she just sort of cleaned up the offices there, because they had been sort of chaotic and free-floating. Her husband, even though he was a member of the Communist Party and the editor of the newspaper, he was quite a flamboyant character. He had apparently written on his wall, "Enjoy capitalism, socialism will be tough," even though they were ostensibly working toward socialism. He liked to drive Porsches and liked to have he enjoyed good living. So Ulrike Meinhof was much more austere. She was much more, maybe one could say, dogmatic. Her tastes were at the time much more geared toward socialist realism, while some of the other people that she worked with were much more open to things. So there were some conflicts, but eventually I think both sides sort of relented and got together, and they put together this highly successful, marvelous magazine that everybody knew. And I mean, everybody knew Concrete. And so even 250,000 copies, I think, doesn't really tell us how much it was read, because the magazine was just handed from one person to the next. Hey, you have to read this. And so Ulrike Meinhof in 1964, when the funds dried up from the East, Ulrike Meinhof really became a brand. She appeared on the second or third page of the magazine with her signature and a little picture, and it said Ulrike Marie Meinhof, and everybody was looking forward to her column. She commented on any and every topic relevant at the time. It was on post-war politics, internal German politics, emergency laws, later on the Vietnam War, later on the student movement. And then her columns, this is what I try to show in my book and in the selection of the columns that's there. So she starts out commenting on Cold War politics and being still very, in a way, naive, one could say, but very hopeful that the superpowers will eventually overcome and move closer together. So when Khrushchev goes to the United States and meets the American president in Camp David, she thinks that's the sign of hope, and that the superpowers will move closer together in the interest of world peace. She later on loses that hope and becomes increasingly involved also with and disillusioned by German internal politics, by the passage of the emergency laws in Germany, by some of the suspension curtailment of civil rights in Germany. And then as she moves into the student movement, she has tremendous hope that the student movement would be a sort of avant-garde for social and political change, but then she loses that hope as well. And in her later columns, sort of toward the late 60s, she becomes increasingly interested in strategy and in, rather than talking about concrete issues about what to change, the question becomes much more, how do we change? And here she engages with the question of violence, with the question of counter-violence. These were some of the discussion at the forefront then. And a lot of it is connected to what happened in the United States, of course, as well. The question of violence, question against violence against things as opposed to violence against people. You have the saying, one of her columns is from protest to resistance. That is a slogan that comes from the American SDS. So there's many, many connections to the United States and many similarities. And then, of course, one could also draw similarities of later on when she does become part of a militant group that uses violence. There are similarities there between the Red Army faction and the Weather Underground in the United States. So many of the developments are very similar that she engaged in. But she herself, of course, became a very iconic figure in that whole struggle. So she, maybe I should talk about her passage from a writer then to a terrorist, so to say. So this happened in 1970, and in the columns in my books, the last column in there, although it's not the last column she ever wrote, but it's one of the last columns she did write for Concrete. It's entitled Columnism. And she writes against her own position as a columnist and criticizes it as a position where a columnist is a star. It's somebody who gives the magazine an alibi. So that the freedom that her position seems to imply would be the freedom that the magazine, sort of the autonomy the magazine seems to project toward the outside world. She had lost complete hope that writing would change anything for her. And she felt that her writing was just serving as an alibi for the magazine to pretend to be liberal, to pretend to be leftist, to pretend to be autonomous, but really that the magazine refused to engage into a certain kind of revolutionary practice. And this is, of course, became more and more the call away from theory, the hatred against theoretical thinking, a real anti-intellectualism crept into her writing that one could describe as a sort of intellectual self-hatred. So the slogans of the day, coming of course from Che Guevara, from Mao Zedong, from Lenin, they were talking about the primacy of praxis. You need to go out, do something. We have to stop talking about things, we have to go out and act. And so Meinhof increasingly sort of became thought that she had to go do something. And it wasn't enough to just write about things, but also to involve herself in activism, in So she in demonstrations and so on. Of course, protesting was also not enough. So hence the column from protest to resistance. So resistance then is no longer just talking or writing, but resistance means to engage in some concrete actions, whatever these actions happen to be. In terms of the Americans, it often meant to burn your draft notice, so on, to put things on fire, to throw bombs. And Meinhof was trying to figure out what it meant for herself. So one in her column, she talked in this column about her own writing. She writes about that she doesn't want to turn her subjects, so the people that she writes about, into objects. She doesn't want to objectify them, but she wants to get to include the voice of those about whom she writes. And that's, of course, very difficult for a journalist, because a journalist is supposed to keep a distance, is supposed to keep some kind of objective point of view. And Meinhof increasingly rejected that position, said that it's not just important what you write about, but how you write about it. So when she stopped writing her columns, she became involved in this. She wrote a script for a television movie. She researched very meticulously the life of institutionalized young women that were institutionalized because the parents didn't want them. They were troublemakers, so they had to work in this institution. She researched their life stories and then came out with this fictional script that one was put into a film. And in this project, she engaged herself very much into the life of these young women. Some of them escaped, and she harbored them at her home. She engaged them in her writing, and so and then eventually she taught a course on filmmaking at the Free University in Berlin, and she told the students there that she was not interested in teaching them anything. What she was interested in was giving them the tools to basically produce propaganda, produce leftist materials and tools to affect social change. So she brought in the girls, and apparently they engaged in the discussions, and the sort of the interchange between the students, who were much more interested in intellectual issues, theoretical issues, and these young girls, who some of them had just a very basic education and had a whole different life experience behind them. I guess the exchange didn't work so well. So many of the students came out of the class, the course, very disappointed, say, well, we didn't learn anything from Meinhof. There were just these young girls coming in, and they were discussing issues that we knew nothing about and weren't interested. In a way, her teaching and the ways in which she wanted to engage the disenfranchised didn't work, and so I think that must have also been the point where she just gave up on writing and went into activism. And then in 1970, when a sort of petty criminal, Andreas Baader, hence the Baader-Meinhof gang, as they were called. So Andreas Baader was wanted by the police because he and his girlfriend, Gudrun Enslin, had engaged in firebombing a department store in Frankfurt. And this is how Ulrike Meinhof met them. She wrote a column on them entitled Setting Fire to a Department Store, where Ulrike Meinhof clearly rejects the idea of going and destroying property. She says basically there's nothing to be gained. The insurance company will reimburse the department store, and nothing will change in terms of society. But she interviewed Gudrun Enslin, she met her, and Meinhof was known to be a very generous person. She opened her home to many people, to some of these young women and to others in need. So when their appeal, Enslin and Bardos stood trial with two others. When their appeal was rejected and it was clear that they had to go and serve time in jail or serve more time in jail, they all served some time, Enslin and Bardos decided they were not going to go back to jail, and they came to Berlin and knocked on Ulrike Meinhof's door. She let them in, but then Bardos was really a reckless person, and while he was wanted by police, he went out and drove without a driver's license and was caught. And so Gudrun Enslin decided that this was sort of the beginning, that liberating some liberating a comrade from jail was a legitimate political action. So a group got together, and Ulrike Meinhof applied at the jail to have Bader visit with her in a university library. Supposedly they were writing a book together about disenfranchised youth, and so the application was denied, but then eventually Ulrike Meinhof came up with a book contract, and so Bader was brought with two guards to the university library. Meinhof was waiting for him there, and the institute where the library was housed was closed for the day or for the morning. And then masked figures pushed their way into the library, and they freed Bader. The original plan had been that Meinhof would just sit there and pretend to be surprised, to pretend to be an innocent bystander. However, the group had not trusted itself to be competent in freeing somebody with weapons, so they had hired a criminal, and somehow this person, who is said to have been a criminal, shot one of the institute employees, and so everybody went into a panic and everybody jumped out the window, including Ulrike Meinhof, and so she jumped out with the group. They left, and this is basically how the Red Army faction came into being, because suddenly they were all underground. Ulrike Meinhof, at the time, she was divorced, but she was a single mother of twin daughters, and she had not made any arrangement for her children. And she then had the children brought to West Germany, and the whole group disappeared, went to, via East Germany, went to a Palestinian training camp, and they started training as guerrilla fighters. And of course, things look very different in West Germany or in Berlin at the time than they look in the Jordanian desert. They learned how to shoot. They learned all kinds of ways of guerrilla warfare. Some of it may or may not have been very applicable to the revolutionary cause in West German cities. So eventually the group came back, and they organized bank robberies and kidnappings. And but basically this first generation, what is now called the first generation of the Red Army faction, they bombed, they kidnapped, they were in action for 2 years, and then All of them were incarcerated one by one. They were captured. Eventually, they were brought together into the same jail that had an extra wing built to them because the German government refused to have them mingle with other prisoners. And it's simply amazing, the German winner of the Nobel Prize, Heinrich Böll, one of the moral voices of Germany at the time, was speaking of a war of 6 against 6 million, because the press and the hype about the group was in no relationship to the number of militants that were actually out there. So there were roadblocks all over Germany, and there was sort of this mentality of siege. The German public was told, watch out for your neighbors. If you don't know your neighbor, who knows, they might be terrorists. And then, of course, the thing that they were stealing cars, and their father liked BMWs. And so for that reason, it's also called BMW Bader-Meinhof wagon. So one of the preferences. And so there was this tremendous sense of surveillance, and German citizens would be suspicious of young people, and there was a real it was just amazing the kind of climate that was the climate of hysteria that was there in the 70s about the group and the group's activities, that was in no relationship to what was actually happening. And so in 1977, well, Ulrike Meinhof committed suicide, although many dispute that. Was it suicide? Was it murder? There was always this question. In any case, she was found dead in her cell, hung from a window. On a date that's memorable, it was an anniversary of the end of World War II, but it was also Mother's Day on May 8th. So many say because the date is so significant for Ulrike Meinhof that she must have chosen to end her life. There's many reasons to believe that, because the group eventually distanced herself from Ulrike Meinhof in just a few days prior to that during the trial. Gudrun Enslin said that the group had no knowledge and didn't want to take responsibility for one of the bombings in Hamburg, for which Ulrike Meinhof had been or is thought to be responsible. So the group really distanced itself from Ulrike Meinhof. She was the bourgeois, they called her very crudely the bourgeois cunt. She was the outsider of the group, and so there's many reasons to believe that Ulrike Meinhof actually had enough, and she knew that her life in many ways was a failure in the sense of she had given up her writing for activism, she had given up her children for this dogmatic group, she was going to be in jail for the rest of her life. So there, in any case, there's many reasons to believe that she did end her own life. The rest of the group, the rest of the first generation, killed themselves, or, well, here also there are questions of were they killed. In 1977, the night of October 18th, the famous death night at the prison, when a hijacking of an airplane that had landed then in Mogadishu, that was a group of Palestinians had hijacked this plane of German tourists, and the German special forces moved in and freed all of the passengers, and most of the hijackers died. So that was sort of, the conditions had been for the release of the passengers had been to free the Bader-Meinhof, the first generation of Bader-Meinhof gang, and what happened there is still, and how the German government reacted and negotiated is still very much object of speculation.
Did the Emergency Act and the clamping down on civil rights, civil liberties in Germany, did that happen before the Biedermeierhof gang was created?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it began in the 60s. There was talk about the emergency laws as early as 1960, and the opposition to the passage of the German emergency laws was also by the German unions, by the Association of German Unions. But it was pushed through in 1968. Yeah, so.
What was the reason for the Emergency Act and the clamping down on the civil rights back when they were pushing for it? What was happening in Germany?
It's an interesting question. What was happening is, I think that was part of the whole trend in the 50s and 60s of establishing Germany as sort of as a Western power, of giving the German state. It was thought the emergency laws were thought to be, to give Germany, or was sold to the German public as a way to guarantee Germany's sovereignty, basically, to give it the right to suspend civil liberties, to give it the right to call an emergency. And it was thought to be necessary to have these emergency laws. I guess you have them. Especially in face of the growing unrest in Germany, that was preceded by the unrest, of course, with the civil rights movement in the United States. So the Germans, I think, were very much looking toward the United States and saying, "Well, what would happen if, you know, here?" So we need some ways of moving in, you know, and suspending the rights. You have the same in Canada, right? In Quebec, it happened, and you know, Trudeau suspended the civil liberties and moved the army into Montreal. So
the threat was an internal threat from the German people themselves, as opposed to an external threat from the Soviets or something else moving into the country?
I think it was both. It was part of the fear of the Cold War, but also very much so, I think, very much internal. I don't know, some historians might disagree with that, but it was the coming together of the threat from the East, and certainly the most liberal. I mean, there was a real, you have in France in 68, of course, this marvelous thing happened that millions of people went on strike. The German public never really supported the student movement in that way. Just the opposite. The students were really sort of the outsider. The philosopher Theodor Adorno spoke about the students taking on the roles of the Jew. There was very much this whole rhetoric about still going back to National Socialism. I think at this one point, the German emergency laws, there was a real solidarity from many, from unions, from liberals, leftist intellectuals, but nevertheless that sort of opposition wasn't strong enough to hold up the laws.
In reading your book, I am curious if you see any parallels between what was happening in Germany at that time in the 60s and what is happening in the United States now. I mean, you had these new Emergency Act laws similar to our Patriot Act here. You have one of the articles she wrote about was about what was happening with Iran, which we're dealing now with Iran mm-hmm. here, and then you're I was really blown away by the fact that apparently our television show here in the U.S., America's Most Wanted, appears to have actually started in Germany in the 60s.
Yeah, that's amazing. That was an amazing show. And the way in which Meinhof writes about it is of course very, very, very. She relates the show used to be called File Number XY. Solved, unsolved, so unsolved crimes on German television, and maybe I should just read a few sentences just to get a flavor also of Meinhof's rhetoric. Usually, to say it from the start, usually what happens in the columns is that they open up with sort of this wonderful polemic statements, and then usually she goes into numbers and facts, and everything gets sort of twisted in a knot, and she pulls out the facts and names, and then toward the end sort of the knot opens up again and she becomes punchy again. So she's always sort of caught between being enjoying the rhetoric and enjoying her own power of polemicism and having to get in the analysis and the facts and but the file number, so she calls it file number XY dissolved. The TV program File Number XY Unsolved Crimes is an enormously fantastic and mass fraud. Once a month, on a Friday evening, several million German and Austrian television viewers go in search of criminals and help the police find unwanted people. They are told the frightful deeds of real-life villains, become eyewitnesses when clues are found, and wait up steadfast in front of the TV for the first results, the final clues from Edward Zimmermann, that's the moderator, whose goal, as we all know, is to put an end to the rise of crime. The fraud is twofold. First of all, the viewers are given the impression that something is actually happening, that there is more than just talk, there's action, which is why the show is so popular. Secondly, the viewers are made to believe they have played an active role because they were allowed to participate and because what happens is in their own personal interest. The gangster we catch today cannot pull a fast one on us tomorrow. The whole thing is a fraud because nothing really happens. And you can be pretty sure that the felon or murderer or thief who is named today will not be the one who will get you tomorrow or the day after. In 1 year, 30 of the 45 people who were wanted were caught, and merely 30 of the thousands who are operating in total freedom. It is hardly successful crime fighting, which is what the program claims to be all about. And the responsibility assigned to the viewer is total nonsense in quantitative terms alone. The two crooks whose fate millions of viewers are asked to wait up until 10:30 at night on December 13 are only two amongst thousands. What is the point of all this, and why do the viewers fall for it? And then Meinhof goes into analyzing how the program is constructed and sort of how Eduard Zimmermann, the moderator, justifies it. Zimmermann at some point said that Germans have to be watchful and watch out to so that National Socialism doesn't happen again. Germans, Meinhof writes, as we know, are fed up with politics. Generally, they equate political engagement with National Socialism, which gave them a bad time. Along comes Herr Zimmermann, who tells them they have to help fight crime, otherwise a new Hitler will come along and do it for them, which makes Hitler a crime fighter, but a crime fighter who overshot his target. Which is why we all have to be aware of the next guy and clean up the country ourselves. Everyone is their own strongman, all grown up now, and in the process the Germans' devotion to Hitler is being retroactively justified, which could reawaken the Germans' willingness to get politically engaged and restore historical continuity, all part of the Germans recovering from the humiliations of the post-war period. So you can see in Meinhof also, of course, the always the references to National Socialism, always the reference to that we must be aware of sort of what she calls the Hitler within you. That there's something in Germans, in German society, of course, that still upholds some of the old order and uses the old order to frighten the population as well. But one of her columns is entitled Hitler Within You, and it refers to the conservative Bavarian politician Franz Josef Strauß, and at the end Meinhof says, one day our children will ask us about Franz Josef Strauß the way we asked our parents about Hitler. Of course, Franz Josef Strauß did not appreciate that and sued Ulrike Meinhof. The other, you referred to another column you were mentioning. Oh, the Fahrradiebe. That's a wonderful column, and in terms of very much in terms of the relevance that you addressed, the open letter to Fahrradiebe is the result of it's a polemic letter, of course. Fahrradiebe came to Germany, and the visit of the Shah with his wife caused many demonstrations in many cities, and this was when the first student was shot in Germany. This was sort of Germany's Kent State that really radicalized the student movement, having this student die, Benno Ohnesorg. And in any case, so the open letter, Fahrradiebe gave an interview to a German women's magazine, one of these trashy magazines, that fluffy things that are around. And Fahrradiebe talked about how wonderful Iran is and how wonderful the Shah is and what kind of upright citizen. So she opens it, "How do you do, Mrs. Pavlovy? The idea that we might write you a letter came to us as we read the Neue Review," that's the magazine, "where you describe your life as an empress. We got the impression that you were not fully informed about Persia, which is why you also provide incorrect information to German magazines. You say, for example, that summer in Iran is very hot, and like most Persians, I travel to the Persian Riviera on the Caspian Sea with my family." Like most Persians? Isn't that a bit of an exaggeration? In Baluchistan and Mehran, for instance, most Persians, 80% of them, suffer from hereditary syphilis, and most Persians are peasants with an annual income of less than $100. And most Persian women see every second child die, 50 of every 100 children from starvation, poverty, and disease. And do the children who spend 14 hours days nodding carpets, do they, most of them, travel to the Persian Riviera on the Caspian Sea in the summer?" She goes on to take every statement that Fahrradiebe made and sort of questions that. I continue here. "You also found that the city of Tehran had changed. Buildings had shot up off the ground like mushrooms. The streets were wider and more spacious. My girlfriends had changed too, become more beautiful, real young ladies. You carefully overlooked the hovels of the lesser millions, the 200,000 people in southern Tehran who live in underground caves and crowded mud huts." She talks about, then Meinhof talks about her jewelry and how the money, how the CIA put the Shah into power, that it was really not the choice of the Persians. "You write, the only difference is that my husband is not just anybody, but that he has to bear greater and heavier responsibilities than other men. What do you mean he has to? The Persian people didn't beg him to become the Shah of Persia. The American Secret Service set him up. You know, the CIA, and it wasn't cheap. The CIA apparently spent $19 million to overthrow, and so on. And in the end, she ends with, by saying, "Okay, one of the constitutional issues is that the Shah must have a wife who bears him children." You write about the Shah's worry about an heir. On this point, the Iranian constitution is very strict. The Shah of Persia must have a son who can one day ascend the throne and into whose hand the Shah can later place the face of Iran. On this point, the constitution is strict and rigid. Strange that the Shah should not give a damn about the rest of the constitution, that he should be the one to determine who becomes member of parliament, contrary to the constitution, and make all parliamentarians sign an undated resignation form before they have been ever admitted, that not a sentence can be published in Iran without being censored, and so on. So she really does her homework. She does her background. She has her numbers there. One of her friends had published a book on Iran just prior to that. What she also brings out, of course, in Iran is the Western interest. She talks about the interest in oil, and you know, to talk about her relevance and what she says today, I think, or the relevance of what she said then to for us today, I think our relationship to the Middle East has and Far East has barely changed. There is still interests, American interests. America goes after its interest. There is, in some sense, I'm wondering, and I'm not sure that that's right. I'm not sure that I'm right, but so, sort of often I think, where are the voices today? Where are the Ulrike Meinhofs today? But I think they're out there. It's just that we don't hear them as much. But then Ulrike Meinhof perhaps was also only heard at the time by a small percentage of Germans and by a small percentage of the left. In her foreword to the book, the Austrian Nobel Prize winner of literature, Elfriede Jelinek, really addresses that issue, addresses what she says is the tragedy of Ulrike Meinhof. And she, in the last sentence of the foreword, she says, "Terrifying and tragic, but also a missed opportunity for society to learn from this woman when she still had something to say that we could understand if only we wanted to." So what Jelinek's take on Meinhof is that Meinhof was really frustrated. She was she was hoping to have an impact. She was hoping to affect social and political change, but did not see that this was happening through her writing. It didn't happen through her activism. So that hence the sort of the darkness of it all. But then if we look at our situation today, there are many people out there fighting for social justice. There's other ways in which groups organize very spontaneously on the internet. There's Greenpeace who goes out and stops, you know, trees being felled. I mean, there's just many, many little things. There's the anti-globalization movement. We may not always agree with the way and with the causes and the way in which this is addressed, but there's much activism is happening today too. It just doesn't sort of make it into the major media. I think, well, you have to look very hard to find it and to hear about it.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Just been talking with Karen Bauer. She is author of the new book, Everybody Talks About the Weather, We Don't, The Writings of Ulrich Meinhof.